In your new leather jacket, you're somebody else. That's Joyce Manor. I'm Blake Murphy, and this is Jays Talk Plus. New jacket, new take on an old jacket, whatever. The home run jacket is back. The Toronto Blue Jays actually hit a home run to get the put on the home run jacket. They piled on runs for the second time in three games. So let's just keep that rolling, whether the jacket's new or old or refurbished. Yes, it was the worst team in the league. Yes, it was a struggling rookie pitcher who had even been struggling at AAA, but you can only beat the teams in front of you. The Jays finally had a fun game where the offense was flowing. They set a season high with 7 runs in one inning. They come up with a 9-2 victory. They finally, after we talked about it on the show yesterday, get a home run from the cleanup spot. Lots of good stuff. Chris Bassett also gives them 7 shutout, and Leo Kikuchi, son of Yusei Kikuchi, on Yusei Kikuchi Bobblehead Day, throws a terrific first pitch. Lots of fun stuff to unpack ahead of this 4-game set in Detroit, in Joe Siddle country, as the Jays look to build a little something here with wins in 3 of their last 4. Nobody is going to raise the banner for taking 2 of 3 against the White Sox. But again, you can only hit off the pitcher in front of you, and Nick Nastrini was that yesterday. There is a lot to do today. We're going to try... a call-in show via voicemail for the first time. You can drop us a message or a question at 416-413-4116. You can also text us to 590-590. As usual, later in the show, we'll tee up this Tiger series. But for now, to break down the White Sox series, the return of the home run jacket, it's our pal Keegan Matheson of MLB.com, of BlueJays.com. Keegan, how are we doing this morning, buddy?
I'm doing well, Blake. I feel like this is a different world than last week when we talked. We're feeling positive today.
Yeah.
I'm the show's positivity correspondent. I think I've been miscast as grumpy. I'm here for the good vibes.
Yeah, look, I don't plan out the guests around when I think the team will win or lose. And the truth is there have been very few guests in the positive slots since Jays Talk Plus return. Another positive we could talk about, and I just want to mention it off the top because it's the biggest news in Toronto sports today, and I know, like me, you're a big WNBA fan. There was a press conference this morning. I believe it's still ongoing down at Hotel X, where this rumored WNBA team to Toronto is official. It's coming in 2026. Teresa Resch will run it as the team's president. She's been in the Toronto Raptors front office for years here. Kathy Engelbrecht, the commissioner of the WNBA, talking about that down today. Stacey Dales was in the house. Kyle Lowry, Scotty Barnes, Masai, Drake, all these people. Keegan, you as a basketball fan, as a fan of the WNBA, excitement level for this one today?
This is awesome. I love the W. I was up last night hoping the Fever came within 5.5 points of whoever they were playing. This has been such a great year for women's basketball, and for Toronto to be on this wave of that is so exciting. And for it to be coming soon, too, not 4 or 5 years down the road, but actually coming up quickly enough where it becomes reality soon. It seems like you've got a lot of big names behind it at this presser as well. I'm looking forward to watching what goes on there. Fingers crossed on the team name. I'm nervous. I'm hopeful, but we'll see. This is exciting. It's been a great year in the W already.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Great timing for Toronto. Great timing for the WNBA to expand as the market grows and the player base grows and things like that. Will be nice, of course, for the country of Canada to have a team. And they've announced, that's part of the announcement, is they plan on playing games in Vancouver and Montreal as well, and the quote is games that matter. In those places as well, not just exhibition games, as fun as those are. So Toronto Blue Jays played in Toronto yesterday. They are not barnstorming around the country. They jumped all over Nick Nastrini, a kid who got called up from AAA with an ERA of almost 6 down in that band box in Charlotte. And the home run jacket is back, Keegan. I will say, donning the jacket, preferable to tipping the cap to the opposing pitcher when it comes to offense-related style guides here.
Yeah, that's a little better. I think people are a little more on board with this. And the home run jacket, I feel like it's been improperly cast as something that's controversial. It's not. Nobody cares about it. It reminds me, Blake, of that old NBA tweet I keep coming back to, and I brought it up here. There's always someone on Twitter arguing with no one, saying stuff like, but I was told Steph Curry wasn't a good shooter. That's kind of my thoughts on the home run jacket. Yeah, there's probably 5 people who don't like it. Let's not pretend that matters. Let's not pretend it's controversial. If even Bo Bichette, who is, I promise you, a very serious dude, if he's into it, everybody's into it. John Schneider's behind it. It's something that's fun. You know, I don't care if they put on a wedding dress, a lederhosen, a swimsuit, whatever it is, do your thing. It's little things like this that break up the monotony of it all. You are playing 162 games, and I know that's something that gets thrown around and almost loses meaning over the course of a season, but it's hard. This season wears me out, and I don't do anything. I sit in a nice press box and eat snacks and write stories. It's a lot. The travel, the wins, the losses on these players. So having something that can be a bit silly, honestly, I know this is far outside of any fancy stats, but something that breaks up the mental monotony of it all, something that gives these guys something to smile about after a couple of weeks that were not full of joy necessarily, it's a good thing. It was surprising to see it back. New design. There's a lot going on. That's my fashion critique of the new jacket. But hey, man, it works. It's not going to change the world, but it might make their day a little more enjoyable to get through. It's all it's about.
Yeah, it's it's loud. There's a lot going on there, but loud contact necessitates a loud jacket.
Graphic design is my passion. It's one of those.
Yes, exactly. All the memes say Steph Curry couldn't shoot. Graphic design is my passion. Well, let's keep
I'm
it
a young
rolling.
Man.
Here.
Yeah, young man.
Yeah, very hip. Okay, so backstory around this, pretty straightforward. The Blue Jays had the home run jacket. They kind of were ahead of the curve. Now every team in baseball has the trident, the beer bong, the sausage, whatever. Every team has a little something like that. The Jays were kind of ahead of the curve a couple years ago, and the home run jacket kind of got, you know, it was by the worst people, like the people who are doing this disingenuously. Well, that's what's wrong with the team. They're not serious enough. They're having too much fun. Well, guess what? It also corresponded with they hit a lot of home runs that year and had a good offense. So that's probably why it was fun, was not the silliness of the jacket or the team not being focused. They hit a whole bunch of home runs and had a ton of offense. Obviously, the jacket is not the cause of that, or the cause, like the absence of the jacket is not why the offense has dried out. But you do see, you know, the jacket went away. Some of the home run hitters went away. Some of the offense went away. It would be nice for all those things to come back together. That's not, you know, other than maybe a small amount of placebo effect, there's not really anything there. However, Bo Bichette kind of said after the game, and you had a quote in your story at BlueJays.com, that he's sensed a bit of an energy shift. And I'm not saying the jacket is that, because this is the first time we've seen the jacket. And I believe his comments were going back to that Washington game where they were able to put up runs in a hurry to come back. Do you buy that the energy has shifted a little bit? I know the wins still haven't come. We're talking about a 3-3 stretch over their last six. This is their first series win in a month. I don't know the extent that anyone cares about the answer. But when you hear Bo Bichette, who, like you said, is a very serious person, say, yeah, the vibe shifted in here a little bit. Are you buying that?
Yeah, the messenger matters here for me. Kevin Gausman said the same thing a few days ago, who's another guy that I trust. There's been a million times over the years, and Blake, I know you've heard the same, both in baseball and basketball, where a player will say, yeah, it feels better. It feels like things are turning. And I'm standing there holding up my microphone saying, okay, just finish the sentence. I know you're feeding me fluff right now. With guys like Bichette and with Gausman, you really trust what they put into that, because they are not players who speak for the sake of speaking. If they're saying something, it typically matters, and they've typically thought about it. They're very well thought out guys. Now, you can't just try harder. You can't just go out and fight a guy. You can't outgrit another team most days. But having that energy is important, because over, like we talked about, 162 games, are you going to be max effort, max engaged for all 162? God, no. There's days where you just got in at 4 a.m. the night before, ideally off a flight and not due to lifestyle choices. But there will be days where you did not sleep well, days where you don't feel good. Lord knows the Blue Jays have had a lot of those lately. There's just going to be days where you've only got 80%. And I think what these guys are talking about is on those days, trying to give all of it, trying to have that energy, whether it is creating it with something on the bases, whether that's keeping that energy in the dugout. Those are those mental and emotional things that are hard to quantify, like you said about the jacket, Blake, but they matter. They do matter over a season that's this long.
Yeah, it's a tough one, too, because you can always get into a chicken or the egg thing. You know, is fun an ingredient, or is it a byproduct, right? Like, you know, the Phillies last year, where they're this, you know, this era's version of that's just me and the boys bopping, you know, and the funny, you know, post-game clubhouse and things like that. Like, is that stuff happening because they're winning, or are they winning because they're loose and they're having fun? But it's one of those things also where you'd rather have it than not, whatever the cause, whether it's an ingredient or an output, you'd rather have it than not. So within this, Bo gets to wear the home run jacket because he's the guy who hits the home run, and it ends a franchise record drought for home runs from the cleanup spot. The Jays had not hit one yet this year. That is the longest stretch of games for the cleanup spot in this franchise's history at any point in the season, and the longest drought to start a season since 1997, I think, in Major League Baseball, when the Astros went like 60 games without a home run from their cleanup spot. And you guys mentioned this to John Schneider pregame, and Schneider called his shot that, yeah, Bo's going to homer today. You also called Daniel Vogelbach's shot on Sunday. What is going on with you and Schneider having this, let's keep it rolling here a little bit. Call a few more shots.
You're next.
Yeah.
Us bearded guys are making good predictions here. I wish either of us had predicted something a bit more useful and beneficial. I guess that benefits Schneider a bit more than me. But it's been a good week for it around here. And that's right. This was brought up to Schneider by Rich Griffin in the pregame meeting. And Schneider had some fun with it. He said, all right, Bo's going to homer today. It worked out. There's some good vibes around this team right now, I guess. But the stat blew my mind. I got that from our research people earlier that morning, and it was jarring. Normally, those stat sheets that we get are a lot of stuff that, yeah, you probably know. I had no idea. And I think this is indicative, Blake, on a larger scale, of a team that has not had a lot of players do what they're supposed to do this year. George Springer in the leadoff spot didn't exactly fill the role of a leadoff man. The cleanup hitters haven't exactly done that, hitting for power, driving in runs, which is what you need from that spot. It's been an offense where, you know, the old do your job, fill your role, that hasn't happened a ton. So if Bo Bichette's the guy there, that's going to work. Schneider had it pretty locked in, so it's a win for John Schneider, too. You know, no tap kipping. They're tap kipping. It's a tough morning for me. But, that's real tough. But at least Schneider got to take a win from yesterday, too, and didn't have to praise the opposing pitcher. It finally all worked out.
Yeah, that's nice to see. From a prediction standpoint, sure. From a home run jacket standpoint, sure. And look, I know that there are probably some people listening. It's like, this is awfully positive for a team that went off on, again, a guy who had an ERA of almost 6 at AAA. No disrespect to Nick Nastrini. He's got very nice eyebrows. I'm sure there is more to the changeup if he can throw that. The changeup looked okay when he did throw it. But we're talking about a guy who throws 93-94, has trouble finding the zone and keeping the zone, had been teed off on in his two starts earlier in the major leagues and was struggling at AAA. Not cause for, you know, backflips and things like that. Eric Fetty on Monday, off to a nice start. Also a guy who was figuring it out to the extent in 2022 that he had to go to Korea and add a splitter before he got back to the major leagues. This is not Roy Halladay and Johan Santana that the Jays have put up 18 runs against in this series. And by the way, these 9 run outbursts bookended a shutout by the hands of Garrett Crochet. However, it is worth noting that the Jays have faced pitchers like this earlier this season and not done this. They've faced an Eric Fetty. They've faced a Nick Nastrini, and they haven't got this done. So I do think that it's fair if fans are looking at this, you know, 18 runs over a series with the Crochet shutout in between and be like, you know what? I'm not buying it that much. They just got to bad pitching. However, they have not got to bad pitching earlier than this. So what do you make of, you know, even acknowledging the quality of competition element here, what do you make of the kind of improved approach that led to these two offensive outbursts this series?
It's something. At this point, you take it. I feel, Blake, up until now, this applied to a lot of last year, too. It was confusing and at times almost annoying because it felt like the pitcher the Blue Jays were facing didn't really matter. It was hard to make sense of who would and who wouldn't give them a hard time. You would see Garrett Cole one day and a guy you've never heard of the next, and the results wouldn't line up with what you expect. Yesterday, before the game, somebody asked me what I thought about Nastrini, and I said, who? I said, what do you mean? It's my head is pretty deep inside Blue Jays, and I hadn't looked at the other side yet that day. I didn't know if they were talking about a player or somebody that I should know standing next to me. The Blue Jays did with that what they finally should have done, which is light the guy up. That's what you're supposed to do. But like you say, there's been so many examples of guys we've never heard of who the Blue Jays have turned into heroes.
Tyler Alexander, a couple days ago.
Tyler Alexander, that's another guy who I learned about. And when these pitchers come around, you have to do damage against them. Yeah, there will be times where you do have to tip your cap, but not every time. And a little bit of logic coming behind this is refreshing almost, because like I said, it's been a year, more than a year, of looking at the opposing pitcher. And if they have a 1.5 or a 7.5, it's almost been difficult to even take anything from that. It's been real luck of the draw, not always going in the Blue Jays' way. So they need to do it 50 more times, but you got to do it once. They've done it once, done it a couple of times, and won the first series in a month. Another number that surprised me, going back to that Padres series.
Yeah, it's a bit of time there, a bit of time. By the way, are you buying this? Are you encouraged by this? Do you like the home run jacket back? You can call us today, 416-413-4116. We'll answer some of your voicemails in the next segment. You can also always text 590-590. Keegan, someone who didn't get in on the action yesterday, but someone who you wrote about earlier this week and has been the Blue Jays' best offensive player. And hey, maybe it's even more encouraging that they did this without Danny Jansen. All nine guys in the lineup got on base. Seven of them got on base twice or more. Eight different guys got hits, and their best hitter so far this season wasn't in the lineup. But you did write about Danny Jansen, so wanted to circle back on that and your piece about how he's kind of become the best version of himself and put aside trying to do the stuff he's not good at. What have you made of where Danny Jansen's got himself to as a hitter and what we can take from that?
Yeah, Danny Jansen fascinates me. I think he's a real encouraging case of player development through your mid and late 20s. We get very fixated, and by we, I mean a lot of me, very fixated on 21, 22, 23-year-old prospects. Do they have power? Okay, if they don't right now, they never will. Can they do this right now as a 22-year-old? No? Okay, they're toast. There's room for development through your 20s in Major League Baseball. Not a lot of players do it. Not a lot of players get the shot to. But I've been so impressed by Danny Jansen these last few years because that's a bold choice to make. It's very easy to listen to your hitting coaches or common hitting philosophy and try to hit the ball around all fields. Try to latch on to a viral hitting tip and make that who you are. Jansen was very simple about this. He realized, I pull the ball, I hit it hard to the left field. Let's try to do that more. And that is so refreshing, honestly, Blake, to talk to as many people about hitting as I do every year. Having Jansen stand out as something that is just individual to him and a little outside what everyone else is doing is refreshing. It perks you up a little bit, especially because it's working right now. Even though pitchers know exactly what Jansen's trying to do, he's trying to get a fastball, hit it to left field. They all know this. He's still making it work, which is really, really sharp of him. He's committed to this. It's been bold. And I think more and more every passing week, him being a pending free agent has to be a bigger conversation. It's tough. He's been in this organization 12 years, I think, almost now. And I remember writing prospect reports on a teenage, almost early 20s, Danny Jansen. Will he grow into power potential? Maybe he's an average offensive catcher. He has changed his entire career. Credit to him. And I think the Blue Jays should do everything they can to keep him around. I think that's really important.
16th round pick back in 2013 out of high school. So, yeah, he's been here a minute. And his free agency becomes fascinating for a number of reasons. Extension conversations, what his free agent market could be for a guy who over the last three seasons has hit as well as basically any catcher in baseball, but hasn't been able to stay on the field regularly. And we know most catchers aren't catching 120 games anymore, but that still affects the market. You know, big catcher paydays aren't always out there, but like low eight figure paydays are out there. So you've got the extension component, the free agent market component, the, if things don't go well for this Blue Jays team, does a contending team want to add a bat at the catcher position at the deadline? And what's that worth headed into, you know, a pure rental at that point? But there's some fascinating Danny Jansen conversations to be had there. I think the way I'd be leaning is let's try to have those extension conversations. You know the guy so well. You believe in the player. You don't exactly have reinforcements in AAA and AA at that position right now, Keegan. That's something to keep an eye on. While I mentioned AAA there, Bison's got rain delayed yesterday, but Bowden Francis did get a third rehab assignment in before the rain came. Chad Green did not get into that game, but they're going to finish that one and play another this morning. Yariel Rodriguez pitched Tuesday initially some concern because he came out after just a third of an inning, but it was just because there was an error in the field and his pitch count was climbing. Any update on those three coming out of that game yesterday, or is everyone kind of on pause right now because of the rain delay?
Sounds like Bowden Francis could come back now after this one, which would be big for this bullpen. They don't really have that true long man right now. Yes, Trevor Richards, some other guys can throw two innings, but someone who can really eat 50 pitches if you need and take some bullets. Bowden Francis, it's been a tough season. I'm really high on Bowden Francis. I spoke about him a lot in spring training, and I would have liked to see him get a bit more of a run as a starter. The context just didn't allow for it. His performance, the Blue Jays weren't there. Would have loved to see him in Major League Baseball get that run, because I think he can do it. But he's a legitimate big league reliever and a long man. Not just a guy who's throwing slop for four innings, but a guy who can actually do something while he's out there. I think that's going to be an important piece. Then if you can get Chad Green back pretty soon, maybe he needs one more outing, but that would be it. That's enough to put this bullpen in a much better place while you wait for Rodriguez. Now, you could move out someone like a Pearson, Genesis Cabrera. His role in this bullpen right now isn't all that encouraging. But having Francis back, I think, is huge in all of this. And then once you get him back, you can be pretty patient. I think they will be patient with Yariel Rodriguez. Build him up a bit, three, four innings. And if 2 weeks from now, you'll see where you are. Maybe between now and then, a starting pitcher gets a bad back and you need the guy. But if everything goes well, you can shorten him back up. And Yariel in a shortened up role is pretty interesting. I think he can really max out. But there's about 10 different ways they can go with Rodriguez. That's kind of the beauty of him. That's why they love the guy. But I think they can slow play that and see which doors naturally open up. These things always do take care of themselves. Yeah. So Yariel can finish wherever that needs him to finish.
Do you have a lean on who the odd man out in the bullpen may be? We kind of, I know it's not exactly this way, but with a huge lead and Chris Bassett going seven yesterday, it almost felt like Genesis Cabrera and Nate Pearson were in like an audition for who keeps their bullpen spot if Bowden is back. And maybe both of them are down to AAA if Chad Green is back this weekend as well. Zach Pop, I guess, being the other option in the mix there.
Yeah, and I think Zach Pop would be third in line there. But I think those two make a lot of sense, Blake. And it's, you know, guys who are obviously very talented, but it's about some consistency in both cases. And watching Nate Pearson yesterday, there's been so many encouraging runs for Nate Pearson over this decade, let alone this season. I feel like I've written 10,000 stories about the guy. It's there. The talent's there. I've always said about Nate that I feel someday he's going to put up a 1.8 somewhere in Major League Baseball. I'm sure it'll be with the Rays at age 33 or something, but it's going to happen for Nate someday. But the consistency hasn't quite been there yet. And the pitch I go back to yesterday, Blake, I believe was in a 3-2 count. Two outs, ninth inning, you're up by a million runs, and he misses with a breaking ball. You throw 100. So throw 100. Get out of the game, throw a strike, and get through this. There's just that that assertiveness from the pitching I haven't seen as much this season. The talent's absolutely there. You can't give up on a guy like that. He's going to keep getting chances, and he should. But I think it would go Pearson, Cabrera, then probably Pop in that group as well. So you can see a lot of change here coming up these next few days.
That plate appearance you're talking about, by the way, that was against Zach Deloach, who was in his, you know, he had gotten on base for the first time in his major league career in that plate appearance. Yeah. And you were up 0-2 in that count and nibbled your way to a walk. So that's a tough one. But yes, I am 100% with you that Nate Pearson is going to go Jeff Hoffman mode at some point, and there will be a season where he's the best setup man in baseball. Absolutely. And everyone will be like, what the heck? But it was like 5 years after he was a starting pitching prospect. Looking ahead, so this is, we've talked about it. This is a pretty pivotal 13-game stretch. We've said, they need to go 9-4 to get back to .500. They've gone 2-1 now. So, hey, quick math, 7-3. You got to go 4 against Detroit, 3 against the White Sox, 3 against the Pirates. This is a Tigers team that hard times late a little bit. They've dropped 4 in a row here. They've dropped 6 of 8, but they can pitch. Even though the Jays will miss Tarik Skubal, they can pitch a little bit. Chris Bassett said to you guys yesterday, once you look ahead, you're screwed about how fans and media, yes, me included, will look at like a chunk of games like this. How do they manage, you know, or how do you think they manage this? Yeah, it's got to be one game at a time, but the standings are the standings and the record is the record. And you do kind of got to be looking at licking your chops a little bit at the Central Division part of your schedule.
You have to be. Maybe not as much as us in the crooked media do, but you have to. You have to live within the reality of your schedule. You're not looking ahead and writing in a win ahead of time. You're not getting that bold. But that reality matters. Coming up on this stretch is really important for the Blue Jays, because the reason we're talking about this stretch is because beyond that, there's some tough ones again. You need to make the hay while the sun shines, and this is it right now for the Blue Jays. Because when you look, Blake, at this season, what are we, May 23rd? You are just over 2 months to the trade deadline, and you need to know what you're doing a few days ahead of that. So let's call this a two-month season right now, really, for the Blue Jays to figure out what they're going to do, what direction they're going to point this franchise in. So you're not even looking about four-plus months down the road and this being a small part. This is a bigger chunk of an extremely important stretch for the Blue Jays to determine how the rest of this year is going to go and really to determine what next year is going to look like. So even though the Blue Jays want to stay focused on today, there's not a ton of todays left before you need to make those choices. So this is key. And going into Detroit, I think it's all about Detroit's pitching. Because when I look at a Blue Jays road matchup, I'm really just looking at the other team's pitching at this point. Any team can scrape across two or three or four against the Blue Jays. But the Blue Jays have shown this aptitude to just get shut out. Are they going to run into a guy who just completely shuts them down? We've seen that same game 20 times. The offense gets shut down. A Blue Jays pitcher makes their first mistake in the sixth. I am copy and pasting that story all season, over and over. So it's all about Detroit's pitching and getting to them. Not just getting to them once, but doing what the Blue Jays did yesterday and putting up seven runs in an inning. Getting to them twice, a third time. Haven't seen that much whatsoever. But it's all about opposing pitching when you are the second worst offense in Major League Baseball.
It's a tough one. And this is, look, it's not the best rotation of all time, and you are missing Skubal, but Jack Flaherty is back to being Jack Flaherty after a bad year last year where the Orioles picked him up and he just couldn't figure it out. Matt Manning has been not great as they kind of wait for him to figure it out. I think this is year four for him as the former number one pick. But Reese Olson's been good and Casey Mize has been good. Like there are arms there, and they have Alex Lang got lit up yesterday, and now his numbers on the season are not that great, but they have a pretty good back end with Lang and Jason Foley and a couple other guys back there. So yeah, this is, I mean, we even ran into this on Tuesday against the White Sox where 3-0 felt big because Crochet was pitching well. And you know, Michael Kopech was at the back end, and that's an inning you can, you know, closers will blow things sometimes, but that's one guy where the stuff you're just like, okay, you're probably not getting anything off him. So you got to get it against John Brebbia in the seventh, right? Like that's the kind of series that the Tigers can present to you. And that's how, you know, until this week, they were hanging around 500 in that Central Division. Jays will counter with Kevin Gausman tonight. It's felt like a positive show so far, but there have been some not great signs with Kevin Gausman so far. And we're probably far enough into the season that he rushed back in spring training. While that's real, we probably got to stop it at this point. He's made a handful of starts. He's made 9 starts at this point. Like, even if that's a real factor and it affects his early season numbers, we're in late May here, and they need Kevin Gausman to be Kevin Gausman. He has a 4.89 ERA. His underlying numbers suggest that's fair. Like, this isn't Kevin Gausman getting BABIPed to death like in 2022 or anything like that. This is, he's pitched like a 4.5-5 ERA guy. The velocity's down a little bit. The swing and miss is down on the splitter. What do you make of where Gausman's at so far and how close he is to being, you know, Kevin Gausman again?
I really think he's almost there. I think in his last outing, he looked a lot better for 4 or 5 innings and then did have a couple drop in that last inning and then gave up some contact. But it looked real good. The start before that, he had some of his best stuff. It wasn't always working out, but he had that velocity.
Was that the Minnesota one?
That splitter. I think so, yes. And the velocity was there. Now, for Gausman, it's all about the splitter. Everybody knows this. And that splitter just hasn't been there for him. He's talked about missing the feel a bit for that, not getting it to drop down as much. So when he's getting those swings, he needs it to be falling off the table, skipping right in front of Alejandro Kirk. Instead, it's kind of kissing the bottom part of that zone. And that's when hitters can really do damage against it. We've seen lineups every once in a while. It typically happens 3 or 4 times a year when they have a really good game plan against Kevin Gausman. They're laying off that splitter. And when it's not good enough, that makes him really rely on a fastball, a bit of a sweeper. It's tough for him to survive like that. I do think he's really close. And I do think that that is a big missing link for this rotation right now, because he is the guy that can go out, pitch 7 innings and strike out 12. You have a lot of guys who can give you those rock-solid outings. Jose Berríos, my goodness. Yusei Kikuchi, Chris Bassett, they've looked great Alek Manoah has looked great. But Kevin Gausman has the potential, I think, above everyone else, to go out and just completely win a game, just decide to win a game. And along this stretch, the Blue Jays need to steal some. They need to hit that three-run home run that wins a game. They need to have a starter go out and just win a game on a day where the rest of the team might not have it. Gausman should be that guy. I'm really interested to see him tonight because the last couple of outings have started to feel like something, but you have to see it. And like you said, Blake, we are past the point of that slow ramp up. I'm a believer that if you're even having a conversation of if a guy's ready, he's not ready. The moment you talk about it, he's not ready. But at this point, he's got to be all the way back. And I think this is a really big one for him. If tonight's difficult, that's a bit worrying, but I think this is when he gets in the good direction.
And it's not a rollover team, but again, this is a team a little under 500 that does it more on the pitching side. They're 19th in runs per game. If we look at home runs, they're third to last in home runs against right-handed pitching. So there are some indicators that this Tigers team, especially with all four Jays righties or three Jays righties going in, then you say Kikuchi, that this could be a good spot for Gausman to get right, a good spot for Alek Manoah to keep it rolling tomorrow. You're not down in Detroit. You tweeted before you came on with me. You're using this weekend, this series to, of course, you'll have an eye on the games. You don't have to do an 11:30 game on Sunday, which fascinated by what the media meal would be for that one. But what does taping your life back together entail for the weekend, buddy?
Man, I got to get this apartment. You know, it may look, I've kind of faked it behind me, but there's a lot of stuff pushed off to the sides here. There's pizza boxes, there's bourbon bottles. It's a lot about getting the fridge back in order, I tell you, because the life of a baseball writer, I'm going to the stadium around 2 o'clock. So you wake up, you worry about lunch, but the rest of your day is taken care of. So that's a very sad, empty fridge right now. It's the hard part of this job is not the writing or the talk to players. That all comes easy enough. It's just keeping your life in order and not eating out every meal. So I'm going to go down to the local grocery store here, go down to Farm Boy. I think they have a produce section.
Okay.
Typically, when I walk into the left, I see a lot of colorful foods that I think are fruits and vegetables. I'm going to investigate that today, see if I can rebuild myself. I'm feeling a little dry, like I haven't been eating the best through a homestand, so we'll see.
Bright colors. It's either fruit and vegetables or gummy bears. So either way, you're good. Keegan Matheson, MLB.com, BlueJays.com, BlueJays.com newsletter, and a book coming out next year that we'll hear more about as the season goes on. Thanks for taking the time out, buddy. Enjoy the weekend.
You got it, Blake. We'll talk soon, buddy.
Keegan Matheson of MLB.com, of BlueJays.com. Some fun stuff from the game last night. Jays take 2 of 3 against the White Sox. Yeah, it's the White Sox. Yeah, they had a shutout sandwiched in between 9-run outputs. But look, it's not something that they've been doing regularly, taking advantage of pitching like that. You like to see them get a little bit on the board, at least reinforcements coming in the bullpen sometime soon. The Buffalo Bisons are about to get in action right now, try to play a game and a half today around rain. I think it's Syracuse, so we'll get, you know, maybe a Chad Green update out of today as well. Find out when Yariel Rodriguez is pitching next. Bowden Francis could be back this weekend. So some reinforcements there. Chris Bassett gave him 7 yesterday. I was a little concerned. The broadcast kept showing Chris Bassett. So he had a glove on so that he could touch the, like, I guess, like Voltaren or whatever the equivalent is. And that way it's not on your hands. So when an umpire checks you, you don't have the goop on you or whatever. But seemed like there was like a neck or a lat thing going on. Still managed to give them 7 shutout. The hits he did give up were to lefties. So this lefty-righty split that Bassett had early last year seemed to fix and is back now. You know, that was still there a little bit, but you're never going to argue with 7 shutout innings, the best start of Chris Bassett's season. And he'll get the White Sox again on his next turn. So can maybe continue building that momentum, get that ERA down below 4, where he probably deserves it to be on merit so far. We're going to take a break. This next segment, we're going to try something new. We're going to take some of your calls, 416-413-4116. You got to leave a voicemail, but we'll play them as quickly as we can. You can also text us, as always, to 590-590 if that's easier. We're going to talk to Travis Sochik of The Score at 11 o'clock. We're going to talk to Cody Stavenhagen of The Athletic for the Tigers side of things around 11:30. But right now, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, it's you guys and me. Call 416-413-4116 or text 590-590. Mailbag segment as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
teeing up the biggest games of the night. It's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. A little mailbag segment here at the end of hour one. We'll try to do this pretty regularly. It'll probably be on Thursdays. So not a ton of calls in the call line today, but we'll try to condition this and build it out. 416-413-4116. You can also, as always, text 590-590 if you got questions or comments. Some home run jacket stuff in there as well. Let's see what is in the call line first. We got a call for a voicemail from Chris in Edmonton. Let's give it a shot.
Hey, Blake. It's Chris Knox. Love your show. Listen every day out in Edmonton, Alberta. Just a semi-comment question. So we won, I think it was 9-2 today. Bassett threw an absolute gem. What do you say? What say you? We got 7 against Detroit and the White Sox combined. What do you think? Can we go 5-2 in the next 7? That puts us, I think, back about 500. What do you say? Love your show. Keep up the good work. Talk to you soon.
Chris in Edmonton, thanks for the first voicemail here on Jays Talk Plus. And yeah, I think that has to be the goal. So you laid it out. They've got 7 here against Detroit and the White Sox. It's on the road, so we know it's hard to take 3 or 4 against a team on the road. It's hard to sweep on the road and things like that. But the Jays had to have been looking at this stretch of schedule. And again, we can hear Chris Bassett and guys like that say they can only take it a game at a time. You know, you lose yourself if you look too far ahead. But we all know what the standings say, and at least we can look at this 13-game stretch that started at the beginning of this White Sox series, and you had to go 9-4 to get back to 500. Now, 500 is nobody's goal for the season, but you got to get back there before you can start climbing up. You want to be there on June 3rd when you know you're done that Pirates series and you're back facing the Orioles and teams you're fighting with for playoff positions. So, yeah, I think, you know, a 2-1 start, ideally you would have swept the White Sox at home, but you took 2 of 3. That means, you know, if you want to keep that pace, you got to take 7-10 over this next stretch here. And yeah, that would require going 5-2 against the White Sox and the Tigers. So it's probably, we'll see. The Tigers have some TBAs on their starting rotation Saturday and Sunday, but you're going to see Flaherty and Manning. You're going to see that good bullpen. It's a team that, again, hasn't hit the heck out of the ball, but they're, you know, they're closer to the middle of the league than they are the bottom in a lot of offensive categories. So it's not going to be a cakewalk. And Detroit, you know, there will be a lot of Jays fans there, but you're still on the road and it's a 4-game series. So I think 5-2 is the goal. I think they'd probably be okay with 4-3, even though that wouldn't, you know, necessarily feel the best. But that would be, you know, you split 4 in Detroit and then take 2 of 3 against the White Sox in Chicago. But I think, yeah, 5-2 should absolutely be the goal. Then you take 2 of 3 against the Pirates back at home and you're at 500 as you start to face division and American League wildcard opponents once again. Couple more calls in the call line. Amit, what do you got for us? Mike in Ancaster. All right, we got Mike in Ancaster here, and then I think we got Jays Retro in St. Thomas coming up as well.
Hey, Blake. Mike calling from Ancaster. Just want to let you know, man, I love your podcast. The information's great. I listen to it every day. Keep up the great work. Thanks very much. Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, thanks, Mike. No question for Mike, but nice to hear nice things like that. Shout out to Mike in Ancaster. Let's go to St. Thomas, lovely little town, see what Jays Retro is saying.
Hey, Blake, it's your buddy Jays Retro from St. Thomas. I've got a question about the trade deadline. I love transactions. Mark Feinsohn published a piece on Monday morning this week with speculation from an AL executive that Bo and Vlad could be on the table at this deadline, given that they have 1.5 years of control. What do you think a package would have to look like to entice the Blue Jays front office to pull the trigger on either of those guys? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, so this one, great question, Jay's Retro. Appreciate it. Shout out to St. Thomas. This is one that made the rounds a little bit on social media yesterday. I thought it got poorly aggregated a little bit. Feinsand kind of just saying, yeah, there are execs who have checked in on the availability of Vlad and Bo, and the asking price would be astronomical. So I think three things would probably have to happen. The Jays would have to continue being bad and probably get even a little worse to where the front office starts. You know, we've talked about potentially retooling this year, maybe being sellers at the deadline if things go poorly, with a focus on being better in 2025. Things would have to go much worse, I think, and probably for the front office to change over before they started thinking, well, you got to tear this thing down to the studs. So that would be the first thing that has to happen. Second thing would have to happen is you'd have to be pretty far apart still in extension talks with both of those guys, which I think is probably fair because both of those guys are going to want to negotiate at their ceiling. Jays are going to want to negotiate where they are right now, and there are a big gap between those things. And the third thing that would have to happen is I think you're talking about like a Juan Soto-ish haul. And I know that that sounds crazy because Juan Soto is a better player and like one of the best hitters in baseball. So maybe it doesn't get quite to that level. But Juan Soto was heading into his walk year. And we know that in baseball, when you trade for a guy who's a pending free agent, even if you're pretty sure you're going to be able to re-sign him, there's an asset cost to that. You get less for a guy who's about to hit free agency than you do for someone with control. So that would be the argument probably for making a Vlad or a Bo move now versus in the offseason. You know, if you're selling a year and a half, a year and two thirds of those guys, that is more valuable to an acquiring team. So maybe you don't get quite the Juan Soto package, but I think that's probably what the Jays would be asking for in either of those cases. We'll talk to Travis Sochik about that one a little bit as well. And in addition, an interesting quote from Kevin Gausman to Rob Longley in the Toronto Sun the other day about how, and I'm paraphrasing here, but if the Jays don't start playing together, they're aware that they might not be together all that much longer. So question from, this is a text line question now from Thaddeus in South Dakota. Cool. He had to DM me because I guess maybe you can't send text to 59590 from the U.S. But this is related to Jay's Retro's question. Thaddeus asked, if we get to the place where it's time to blow the sinking ship up, what's the most important position group or type of prospect the front office needs to get back? This is an interesting one. So, you know, based on the strength of the system, you'd probably lean a little bit more toward the starting pitching side. This also depends a little bit on the timeline you'd want to start competing against in, where if it's like, yeah, by 2026, you want to be back in there, you're probably focusing a little bit more on pitching prospects toward the high minors. Having said that, the most important thing would be just getting talent in the door. I'm not going to, you know, all things equal, maybe you lean slightly toward the pitching side because from high A on up, the Jays have a lot more going on the hitter side than pitching side. You know, in the lower levels of the minors are where some of the Jays' more interesting pitching prospects are, the ones who are healthy anyway. So maybe you have a slight lean there, all else equal. But really, in that scenario, you'd just be trying to get as much talent in the door. The attrition rate on prospects, the rate at which guys hit, is not significant enough that, the attrition rate is high enough, the rate at which guys hit not great enough that you want to be like, okay, this is our for sure shortstop in 2027. This is our number three starter in 2026. Things don't work that way. So you just get the best talent in the door if you can. Here's a question from my friend Will, who was at a Blue Jays game recently and texted me and asked, why are there no Danny Jansen jerseys or even shirts at Jay's shop at the Dome? I don't have a good answer for this, but Danny Jansen has been the Blue Jays' best hitter. They did a Danny Jansen giveaway night with the glasses and everything. I didn't go into the Jays shop to verify this myself, but yeah, if there's not Danny Jansen gear in there, look, if there was a time where I could buy a Ryan Tepera jersey for a friend, we got to get a Danny Jansen little merch stand going at Jays shop. So hopefully that happens soon. Danny Jansen, obviously one of the most popular Blue Jays, been here for a significant amount of time here, and he's been the Jays' best hitter so far this year. We got a bunch of home run jacket questions. Rick and Markham says, how can anyone be against the home run jacket? We only see it when the Jays hit home runs. That's a good thing. I agree, man. I didn't like the criticism of it back in 2022. I thought it was a little bit of a focusing on the wrong things that were wrong with that team. I don't think the fact that guys had fun and guys had fun with home run jackets and the home run hitters happened to be sometimes shaky corner outfielders. I don't think those things were really related. I think those guys were shaky corner outfielders at times. And also, they hit a bunch of home runs, so had fun with the home run jacket. I don't think the home run jacket was making them shaky outfielders, because they were shaky outfielders before and they're shaky outfielders after. It was also just a little bit of, you know, the blame got a little, or not even the blame, but the focus was too much on the Barrio part of the dugout, in my estimation, when that was a much more team-wide and build kind of issue than it was anything about, you know, Lourdes Gurriel Jr. or Teoscar Hernandez or anything like that. So, yeah, it's fun. It's Brandon in Manitoba is less sold. He says, I still don't know what to think of the home run jacket. It's a game, so you should have fun, but I'm still more on the concentrate on winning side. To that, Brandon, I'd say, first of all, every team in baseball is doing this now. Home runs are a good thing. You're never going to hit it. Like, I would get it if they're like, you know, if they're down to the Orioles or the Yankees 8-1 and someone hits a solo shot and they really do it up with the home run jacket, I would understand it then. But game like last night where it's a home run that breaks the game open, you know, especially if you ever hit one in a big spot in a tight game, things like that, I think it's a good thing. Home runs are correlated with winning. So that's a good thing there as well. Paul in Sealy Bay asks, looking at Turner's splits, I wonder if a platoon is a good way to break Votto in. So the tough one there, Paul, first of all, if you've missed the latest on Joey Votto, we've asked about it a bunch. He continues to work at the complex down in Florida. In addition to the ankle injury that he suffered in his one spring training plate appearance, he had gotten sick a couple times, according to Ross Atkins. So that's a tough one there. And yeah, he just hasn't got back to 100%, doing some hitting stuff, doing some fielding stuff, doing some running stuff, but no game action as of our last update. Eventually he'll be at AAA, but he wants to be 100% before that. Paul, to your question, if he eventually gets back to the majors, that would make sense. I think you can make a case right now that there should already be a little bit of a platoon, and it wouldn't be a straight platoon because I don't think Daniel Vogelbach has played well enough to play every game against righties, but you're going to be wanting to find some Danny Jansen DH days as well. So maybe the combination of Jansen, Vogelbach, Turner is how that playing time split works out for now. We'll see with Votto. I hope he gets back soon. Would love to go down to Buffalo and catch him in the game. Darren from Swift Current asks if this show is a podcast as well. Yes. If you look at the Blue Jays Talk podcast feed, where we also have, you know, Blair and Barker doing their Jays Talk postgame, or Shoa Ali doing Jays Talk postgame, that's where this show lives in the podcast feed. Mark in Tilbury asks if we can get a Blake and Keegan side podcast. I appreciate the kind thought. I think me asking Keegan to come on once a week is probably all he will put up with me in that regard. Alan Kitchener, this is a question from the region, asks if Alek Manoah is back. So Alek Manoah is not Cy Young Alek Manoah back. I'm not willing to go that far. But I've come around a lot in these two starts. There was the good start at AAA at the kind of end of his rehab assignment where it was obviously encouraging, struck out a lot of guys, but there were a couple little red flags. And the biggest one of those to me was the confidence in that sinker, that two-seam fastball that he throws. He was nibbling too much, and when he would nibble, you know, with that, he would spray the fastball, and he just wasn't around the zone enough, even though that start was very good. And then his first start back up was not particularly good. I've been very encouraged by what we've seen the last two starts, both in terms of, yeah, the results, but how confidently and how effectively he's locating that two-seam fastball around the edges of the strike zone. So he needs that to be in the zone because, you know, we've seen him when he loses the zone with that pitch or gets too cute with that pitch and it's too many walks and it's hit by pitch and things like that. He needs that to command the inside of the plate against righties. It's a really important pitch. He threw that in the zone 61% of the time his last start, and they did nothing with it. They didn't even get a single piece of hard contact in play off of it. And that's, you know, not an elite offense, but a pretty good offense in the Tampa Bay Rays. So that was really encouraging to me. The changeup to lefties has looked better over these two starts than I can ever remember it looking. The one thing that I would still say is that slider, it's gotten some swing and miss. It's not all the way back to 2022. And that pitch getting back to being a wipeout pitch is what would get Alek Manoah, you know, back to where he was. I think where he's been these last two starts, though, is really encouraging. I think his next turn being against this Tigers team that is third from the bottom in home runs against righties, so you maybe don't worry about the big shot there. I think that's another good recipe, a situation where he can really, really attack hitters and be in the zone with that two-seamer, use the slider and changeup to keep guys off balance. I'm really excited for Alek Manoah's next start, which I wouldn't have said a couple weeks ago. We'll be back after the break with the second hour.
unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Fun first hour there with Keegan Matheson and you guys texting on the text line 590-590, calling in as well. We'll do the call-in thing next Thursday as well. We'll try to keep it regular on Thursdays. The mailbag's always open, 590-590 if you want to text in. We'll try to scatter those in throughout most shows. Also playing a little Suicide Machines there for you, a little Tony Hawk-ish video game punk music from Detroit to get you ready for this Tiger series. Before we go to Detroit, though, we're going to go to Cleveland and talk to our next guest. He's at The Score, also the author of Big Data Baseball and co-author of The MVP Machine. It's Travis Sochik. Travis, good morning, man. Thank you for doing this. How are we doing?
I'm doing well. Great to be with you.
Thanks. So you are at The Score, but you are Cleveland-based as well. So you're not, you know, I don't get to see you down at the ballpark, but I've been reading your stuff for years. And, you know, this bat speed stuff comes out, all the new good, hey, there's the bat speed, there's the swing length, and we compare that with exit velos and launch angle and all that stuff. And I know that there are some people who have no time for it. There are some people who have a lot of time for it. You wrote what is a pretty definitive piece, though, for The Score on that no matter how we slice these things up, this series excluded, because the Jays have hit, there wasn't really a way we could look at the Blue Jays offense as of a week ago and say, hey, this has been a good group. Now, obviously, that's the case with runs per game and WRC plus and things like that. But in that piece, you kind of paint a bleak picture of what even the underlying situation looked like for the Blue Jays. Where are you overall on this Blue Jays offense right now?
Yeah, I think there's only so much they can really address or fix this season. And you look at some of the underlying, bat speed is a new underlying measure we have. And the Blue Jays at the time of publication for that piece ranked last in the majors in bat speed. And yes, that's not everything. The primary skill, you still have to hit the ball. And the Blue Jays strikeout rate is in a good place. But bat speed does matter. That is strong relationship with hard hit rate and exit velocity. And I mean, just look throughout the game's history, the best hitters generally hit the ball hard. To have a high ceiling, you have to have generally a very high exit velocity, and that has a very strong relationship with bat speed. So when you're lacking, when you're last in the majors, it speaks to there's only so much upside within this group. And a player, we can get into more of the underlines, but like a Vladimir Guerrero is one of the Blue Jays with above average bat speed, but even he is not really directing that well. There's so much hard contact to the center of the field where there's the least slugging of any batted ball direction, too many hard singles up the middle, and that's why I think his slugging is still under 400, I believe. So they're not even optimizing the players who do have this above average, you know, bat speed metric. So yeah, I think you look at that, you look at the batted ball direction data, like the best batted ball outcome you can have is a ball in the air, line driver, fly ball to your pool side, because that's where most power is for hitters. That's where fences are generally the shortest in major league ballparks. So that's where, you know, OPS is the highest, and the Blue Jays are in the bottom third of that category too. So that's something that maybe they could address, but you look at that underlying bat speed measure and it's just like, you know, do they really have the firepower to compete in a really tough neighborhood that is the AL East?
So this is helpful to hear, because a lot of the times when we talk about Vlad and some of the underlings, you know, there is a segment of fans who will push back and who cares about exit velocity? Who cares what the analytics say? And now we have enough information that we can say, well, yeah, you're right. Exit velocity isn't everything. We can measure all these other ways in which, yeah, we can now see, you know, exactly why hitting the ball that hard is maybe not materializing in extra base hits, why you're stuck on a 383 slugging even after a month where you've hit the ball really well from a contact perspective. Travis, what have you made of Vlad's May here, and I guess it extends into late April a little bit, but he's hit at like a near 400 clip with an OBP up near 500 for a couple of weeks here, but the extra base stuff still hasn't come around. What do you know, is that maybe like, do we need to recalibrate a little bit for the type of hitter Vlad is going to be even when things are working well?
I mean, he's certainly been productive, and you know, if he could replicate that over a full season, it would be kind of an unusual profile for his underlying skills, but that would work. The problem is, I think, you know, he's riding a high batting average and balls in play wave, and you know, this isn't sustainable. So you'd like to see him be more like the hitter he was in 2021, and he can be. I mean, he's shown us that. And one of the real, I think, concerning things when I look under the hood is you look at Bichette, Guerrero, and George Springer's older, so it might be more age-related, but they're going back to this, the pulled fly ball, air ball measures. You know, they're in decline for 3 years in a row for these guys, and that's not good. I mean, you look at the Orioles, the Dodgers, these are some of the best hitting teams are launching balls into the air to their pull side, and they're teaching it. A Gunnar Henderson, he's got 16 home runs now. He continues to develop and add this skill. So I think the Orioles are a great example of what's possible on the player development side. And of course, a lot of that group came from Houston, where they developed the Kyle Tuckers and the Yordan Alvarezes of the world. So yes, I think it's kind of a two-part, I'm rambling here, but it's kind of a two-part issue. Like, there is only so much upside in this group, but they're also not getting all they can out of their best players, Bichette, Guerrero. So you'd like to see some of that change. Can it change in midseason? You know, I don't know. Davis Schneider does this really well. Dalton Varsho does it really well, but they sort of developed it on their own. You know, Justin Turner is one of the OG swing change launch angle guys, and he talks about this. You know, since he was a Los Angeles Dodger, he's willing to help teammates. Cody Bellinger with his swing playing and drills and techniques and all this. So they have voices around doing this, but they're not getting to their optimum outcomes. And I know there's going to be there's probably some people rolling their eyes listening to me about new batted ball metrics and all this stuff. But look, Ted Williams had a launch angle and an exit velocity, and I'm willing to bet they were pretty optimum. Babe Ruth, Willie Mays, we just couldn't measure it. But, you know, there are ideal outcomes. Yes, you need to hit the ball, but to have a truly elite upside, you have to hit the ball hard and hit it in a batted ball direction where you're most likely to have an extra base hit. So some teams do it better than others, and the Blue Jays are lacking in this area.
Yeah, I mean, the Ted Williams is always a great one. You can go back to an old Tom Verducci piece in the Sports Illustrated vault with him talking about how, yeah, he's trying to pull the ball in the air. And that's a guy who, you know, hit up around 400, but he was still trying to do his most damage pulling the ball in the air. And I think what you said there is important, right? Is there's two factors here. We look at all of these underlying things to try to figure out, okay, well, why aren't the Jays getting the most out of guys? But then the other component of it is, yeah, the collection of offensive players they have also isn't good enough, or at least hasn't been so far this year. So Travis, there was something going around the other day, and you know, Kevin Gausman gave a quote to Rob Longley of the Toronto Sun that basically they know that if they don't start playing better, the group might not be together all that much longer. I know you tweeted that headline out when you guys had it, you know, at the Score as well. What did you make of that comment? Do you think the Jays should be, you know, feeling that kind of urgency, because there could be a pivot ahead if they don't come out of, you know, this series of lighter schedule with, you know, with a record a little closer to 500, a little more commensurate with playoff hopes?
Yeah, I think Gausman was speaking the truth, and I'm sure the clubhouse understands that if they continue to play poorly, the front office, I'm sure they are already gauging interest in some of their players who are nearing the end of club control. You know, this group is going to be broken up. And this is an important stretch where the schedule is a little softer, as folks well know. So I think, you know, he's being candid and honest, which is what fans and media want to hear. So yeah, I think it's a pretty accurate appraisal. The one thing helping the extra wild card spot, you know, will keep a large pack of teams in theory give them a puncher's chance deeper into the summer. So the Jays have that going for them. And I also wonder, you know, just given the state that their farm system ranks lower, at least according to the Baseball Americas of the world, I do think they should be a little more patient, because I think you'd be trading low on a Bichette if you're exploring that, and even a Guerrero. And I just wonder if those guys have more name value than actual trade value at this point. I just think, even though this is a pivotal stretch and they could very well break it up, I think it's probably a season where you want to be patient, because I think a rebuild could be a long and painful process. So before embarking on that, it's you want to think long and hard about it.
Yeah, I'm, you know, I have 2 hours to fill all summer. I'm not as eager for that for the next couple of years as some. But yeah, I think there's, yeah, and you tweeted as much as well, that there was probably a disconnect between the name value and where the expectations were for Vlad and Bo long term and where we thought their next contracts might be and what the actual value in trade is right now. Also, the Jays would ask for the world for those guys, which is kind of what Mark Feinsand said to start all of this conversation in general. So with respect to Kevin Gausman, Travis, he made those comments. That's, he's a truth teller. He's a pretty real guy and tells it like it is. He has also been pretty straightforward that he hasn't felt his best so far this season. ERA up around 5, some of the underlying metrics that support that. Now, he's still, the velocity's down about a tick on the fastball and the splitter, but he's mostly looked like the same kind of pitcher approach-wise and things like that. What have you made of Kevin Gausman's slow start here and the small dip in effectiveness for that splitter?
Yeah, I just, you know, he had the injury concern pop up in the spring, and you just wonder if, I just doubt, I think he said as much as you pointed out, that he's just not, feeling 100%. And will that improve as the season goes along? The Jays have to hope so, because a lot of their, the front office consciously traded run scoring upside for run prevention type players in their position player group. And they're counting on, the staff was so good last year. They're counting on they probably expected some regression, but not this level of regression from a lot of their arms. So they really need to be a run prevention pitching first group. And that hasn't, played out as well as it had a year ago. And there is a risk in doing that in the AL East, where there's generally just so much offensive firepower. And now you have the Tampa Bay Rays after slow start getting healthier, although I see Josh Lowe might be hurt again. But you have the Orioles popping up as a dynamic team. Yankees look great. Red Sox young position player group looks pretty good. So there's a risk in going run prevention first, I believe. So they need Gausman to be great, Bassett, all these guys. Kikuchi's been generally pretty good, but they need their pitching to be as a group more like they were a year ago.
Yeah, it's always an interesting one when that is going in one direction and your offense is going in the other direction. We look at Major League wide and offense is so light. And the Jays have obviously contributed to that with the light offense. And then, you do have a couple, and always pitchers are going to be up and down, and it'll normalize by the end of the year, or it won't. And guys have outlier seasons, but offense is down league wide. So it's, it's a little interesting for Gausman. It's a little interesting to put the Jays in that context. You tweeted out something the other day where you took, because offense changes over the course of the season. So it's information to compare where the offense level is right now to all of last year, but it's really helpful to compare where things are right now to this date last year. And what we see is that batting average is down about 8 points versus this time last year. Batting average on balls in play is down about 8 points relative to this time last year. Home run per fly ball rate is down 1.5 percentage points, which doesn't sound like a ton, but is like that. That's trimming the number of home runs on fly balls by about 10%. Overall, what do you make of all of those things kind of going in the same direction to start this season?
Yeah, I am reporting a piece for later in the week at the Score on this, so shameless plug. it is interesting to see what's going on, and the ball has seemingly changed every year, so I think it's a culprit. It's probably the ball might be playing differently this year, just looking at that home run to fly ball ratio, but it is fascinating to see batting average down 8 points in the second year of the shift ban. And while warmer weather will push up some of these numbers incrementally, it does look like batting average will be down for the year unless something dramatic changes. And batting average, and even with the shift ban, batting average on balls in play is down 8 points. And I don't see defensive alignments much different than they were a year ago. So, I was in the Mets clubhouse the other day and spoke with Pete Alonso and Francisco Lindor, and they were both saying that, look, maybe it's the ball, but pitchers are also just, they keep getting better. I mean, last year's a sweeper. This year, the splitter's up. It's a double. It's up 3 three times over the usage what it was 2 years ago. So each year you have pitchers going out, adding velocity, adding skill, adding new pitches, and you know the amount of data and scouting on opposing hitters is so great. The ability to adjust in real time is can happen faster than ever, and of course they start with the ball in their hand. They dictate action. So just even with the rash of injuries we had early in the spring to the Striders, the Coles, some of the best pitchers in the game, the overall level of pitching off the mound is incrementally getting better every year. And there's only so many rule changes. Well, you could make dramatic rule changes, but I think the rule changes baseball made, you know, the shift ban really isn't having that much of an effect.
Yeah.
And, you know, Lindor even pointed out, look, that's really only addressing line drives in the short right field. So, I think it's a combination of factors. The ball's probably playing a little differently. The humidors are something of a black box. Like, who knows what the settings are on those year to year. And then the pitching's getting better. So I don't think hitting talent is getting any worse. These guys are the best in the world. So it is curious, but it is definitely a depressed run scoring environment. And it'll probably change somewhat in the summer, but I think unless a new baseball is rolled out midseason, I think we're looking at lower run scoring for the year.
I do want to dig in a little bit more on that, but you mentioned you spoke to Francisco Lindor in the Mets clubhouse. How was his return to Cleveland? Because I know he's been gone 4 years, but I think that was his first time back playing there, right?
It was. And his first plate appearance, he mostly had cheers, some boos mixed in, and you know, he had a great run in Cleveland. I think he, you know, he left a little bit on a sour note, and it was kind of surprising that there was no video montage from the club.
Hmm.
And, you know, I think the team, you know, his last year he said he didn't want to be called Frankie anymore, and the team Twitter account said they tweeted out something like, "Welcome back, Frankie," which was odd. So, you know, behind the scenes, it seems like their relationship soured at the end, but yeah, he was a great player here. I know he's off to a slow start this year, but he's still a great player. And it would have been nice to see a little bit more of a warm embrace from the club. But it was interesting to see. But from the fans, mostly cheers. And yeah, he was a great player. And Guardians got Andrés Giménez back in that deal, so it worked out for the Guardians too. So it was interesting.
Yeah, I was a little surprised I didn't see more like positive stuff. And the Frankie thing's interesting for anyone who didn't catch it. Lindor's take on that is, well, that is a very like Americanized way of saying his name, Francisco. And he was named Francisco for a reason. His grandfather was named Francisco. He would just prefer to be called by his actual name, Francisco. Not the hugest of deals, but then, yeah, when he says that and the team goes and calls him Frankie anyway, it seems a little odd. Okay, Travis, back to the offensive environment stuff. You wrote The MVP Machine, which is one of my favorite baseball books. I think it made me immensely smarter as a baseball fan. And in that, you're talking about how teams and then players outside on their own through things like drive line and stuff like that have been using data and information and these high-tech cameras and things like that to build better baseball players. And now we're seeing, you know, some of the externalities of that, which is that, yes, it's cool that everyone throws harder and the pitches break more, but offensive environment is down, pitching injuries are up, etc. You tweeted out a really good graph the other week too of it's not even just that the average velocity is higher, or the top velocity is higher, but the range of velocities guys pitch within is narrower. So you don't see a guy throwing 91 and then he has a 98 mile an hour fastball when he needs to dust it off. We actually do see Kevin Gausman do that a little bit, but for the most part, guys are like, okay, if I'm a 96, I'm in the like 94 to 98 range pretty tightly. That book was a couple years ago now, but as kind of, you know, you look back on writing and reporting that book and where baseball has gone since on the pitching side. Does this kind of feel like not only the offensive decline because of the quality of pitchers, but also maybe some of the increased injury stuff seem a little inevitable with the way that training was kind of exponentially picking up pace and guys were able to train for velocity and bigger break and things like that?
Yeah, I do think the injury, it's impossible to know for sure, but I do suspect that the max effort throwing is tied to it. And you know, even Justin Verlander said a few weeks ago that earlier in his career he could cruise at a lower range in his velocity, and then we think about him pitching later in games, and there's 98, there's 99, and that's amazing. But he could do that in part because he was cruising at, for him, what was a lower velocity for some stretches of the game. And now even he said that's harder to do, in part because the skill level of batters has improved, and also because batters have somewhat adapted to a higher velocity environment. And it's pretty wild, but the median max velocity of pitchers now is 97, meaning that half the pitchers in baseball can throw as hard as 97 or faster. That's pretty crazy. I used to think back, like, I think it was a Fox telecast, when someone would hit 95, they'd show the mile per hour reading, and like a flame would appear on it. And now that's just like an everyday velocity. No, it's not even special, which is insane. But, and the incentive is to pitch at the major league level, to be drafted, you have to, and to have success, you generally have to have great velocity. But the trade-off is injury risk, of course, seems related to that. And in part, I think, just the max throwing element of that. As the gap between min and max velocity continues to shrink each year for pitchers, and that suggests that pitchers are throwing near their top capabilities. And they're also throwing shorter outings, so that might be part of it too, where they feel like they can empty the tank because, we don't see starting pitchers throw as deep into games and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I think, this, it all ties into, optimizing talent and skill, and there are negative trade-offs like injuries. And I do think the game, when there's fewer balls in play, becomes a little less interesting. And I do think Major League Baseball is right to try to incentivize more balls in play and make that happen last year with some of the rules. So all that is a big negative. The one thing that makes me a little hopeful is guys like Tanner Houck and Logan Webb, who have used the new tech and training tools and understanding of discoveries of like seam shifted wake and how balls interact with the air. They've become better pitchers, not by throwing at a higher velocity range, but by just embracing kind of the way their bodies move and the movement they produce on their sinker, changeup, sliders. And, Houck he's not trying to throw 97. He's just trying to let the ball manipulate the ball as he can. And it's worked to great success this year. So, hopefully there can be other ways of pitching that emerge that aren't just max velocity. Not that everyone can do it, but maybe there's some more Logan Webb and Tanner Houck stories out there that can push down injury rates a little bit, because it was alarming this spring to see the amount of talented arms being injured.
Yeah, and hopefully it's a cautionary tale as hitters try to catch up, right? And we have, new metrics and new ways of evaluating hitters, and there's some concern, Tristan Casas talked to Eno Saris about, like, yeah, if you train for bat speed for, and again, bat speed like velocity is you can succeed without bat speed, but all things equal, it's better to have more of it. And like, yeah, if you're the size of Tristan Casas and you're training for maximum bat speed, you're probably going to have oblique injuries pop up. Josh Lowe, who you mentioned earlier, hit the IL. That was an oblique issue in spring training. So there's some risk there as well. Travis, I had sent you a bunch of notes of other stuff we could rapid fire hit on, but I'm running long with you here. So we'll do the team that the Blue Jays are going to see next, since this is a Toronto show. You wrote not too long ago about how good a job the Detroit Tigers have been doing, not just developing their own pitchers, but when they bring guys in, helping them find better versions of themselves. What have the Tigers done so well on the pitching side?
Yeah, you look at some of these success stories with Jack Flaherty, looks like a completely different pitcher, or like he did at his peak a few years ago with the Cardinals. Tarik Skubal has been amazing. And, they brought in a new management front office group, leadership group, new coaches like Chris Fetter on the pitching side. And they're a team that can, not too long ago, they're pretty hapless on the pitching developments side, and now all of a sudden they look like maybe baseball's new pitching factory of sorts, where guys go to rehabilitate their careers. And it shows you how quickly you can pivot as an organization, I believe. And I don't believe the success is fluky. I think they are taking on some of the best practices on the pitching development side. They're not willing to divulge all their secret sauces, but it does seem like they've joined the ranks of the forward-thinking clubs, and it's a new, what was one of the weaker pitching development teams now seems like the stronger one, one of the stronger ones, which makes everyone in the American League, all their opponents, life is now a little more difficult. And slowly the AL Central might be a tougher neighborhood over time. We'll have to see. But yeah, I do think this is legit, and they are not a team you can just expect to go and walk over, as had been the case in recent years. They're a tougher opponent now. And if you're struggling to score runs, they're really not the pitching staff you want to face.
Yeah, and guess who the Jays get to face? We'll see. Maybe getting to beat up on the White Sox for a couple games will help them head into Detroit in a better spot. We also don't know exactly who the Tigers are going to be starting in the back end of this series, but should be a fun one nonetheless. Looking forward to talking to you again soon, Travis. Maybe when the Guardians and the Jays meet up. Thanks for taking the time out this morning, buddy.
Absolutely. Yeah, great speaking with you. Yeah. Thank you.
Travis Sochik of The Score, author of Big Data Baseball, which at the time the Pirates had pulled out of their 20-year losing streak, was a really good look at how they'd kind of used the new information wave to do that. Now, the Pirates have taken a step back since then. Henry Davis is back in the minors, but they've got a Paul Skeens. They've got a Jared Jones. This is like year 8 of the second part of the rebuild, but maybe things are moving in the right direction there. Also co-author of The MVP Machine, which was a fascinating read when it came out and a fascinating reread now that we're seeing some of the positive and negative consequences of how pitchers have been trying to build themselves up over the years for greater velocity, greater movement. That book goes into the hitting side as well, but it's, we know a lot more about the pitching side, and the injury issues are more prominent on the pitching side right now. Speaking of pitching injuries, Kenta Maeda may come off the IL this weekend for the Detroit Tigers. That is some speculation right now that he could potentially do that and start Saturday or Sunday. Evan Petzold of the Detroit Free Press reporting that he's been on the IL with a viral illness. So not something that he would maybe need a long rehab appearance, if a rehab appearance at all. There are some other options there for the Tigers. Currently, Jack Flaherty and Matt Manning are on the probable pitchers list. And then we'll see two of Reese Olson, Kenta Maeda, Casey Mize. Let's take a break. Let's bring in Cody Stavenhagen of The Athletic, who covers the Tigers over there. Get to know this Tigers team a little bit better. It's a Tigers team that, until this week, was overperforming a little bit. If you're me and Ben Nicholson-Smith, you thought this Tigers team could get into the 75 win range, be a little spicier this year than last because of the nice pitching, a couple of the nice young players. They've done that so far, again, until this week. So we'll see what's wrong. We'll see what's going right with Cody Stavenhagen as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Nick Kiprios.
And I'm Justin Bourne.
We're diving deep into everything happening in Leafland and the biggest stories around the NHL.
Real Kipper and Bourne, weekdays from 4 to 6 on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. The Jays take 2 of 3 against the Chicago White Sox at home. They are now in Detroit 4-4. And I'm going to run you through the schedule because it's a little unconventional. They'll play at 6:40 tonight and tomorrow. They will play at 1:10 on Saturday. And they'll play at 11:35 a.m. on Sunday. That's because the new Roku package. There is no change to that for you, the Canadian viewer, though. We will still have Dan, Joe, and Hazel on the call for all 4 of those games on Sportsnet. Jamie and Caleb for Blue Jay Central. I'll join those guys on Saturday as well. And then Ben and Chris with show hosting on the radio side. Ben Nicholson-Smith down in Detroit for us for this series. Let's head down to Detroit now. Let's talk to Cody Stavenhagen of The Athletic, of the Turning the Corner podcast. Good morning, man. Wow, hair is looking sharp. How we doing, buddy?
Doing well, man. How are you?
I'm good. Gotta ask, this is a little inside sports media, but before we get into the Tigers stuff, you are, and I know a job is a job in the industry and things like that, but you are a Texas kid who went to Oklahoma. How much did it hurt you to start at The Athletic covering Michigan football?
It didn't hurt me by any means, you know. I think the Big Ten and the Big 12, it's kind of like two separate worlds.
So. Okay.
I really didn't feel strongly about Michigan one way or another, and it was a great job.
So. All right, and now here you are on the Tigers side doing a great job there as well. This is a Tigers team that I thought it would be pretty fun this year. I thought they'd take a step forward. It's looked like that so far. This has been a tough week for them. And yeah, it's not the 1984 Tigers who you wrote about today, who started the season 35-5, but it's a pretty good start up until this last week, hanging around 500 and stuff. What has gone well for the Tigers to start this season? And then, you know, things off the rails just a little bit this last little bit.
Yeah, it's been interesting because I think there's a lot of frustration from the fan base right now. People who hoped this team would be fun, hoped it would be exciting. We saw some of that in April, and then it's been a pretty rough go of things in May. I think it boils down to the pitching overall has been pretty good, starting pitching in particular. The bullpen started off dynamic. It's really leveled out to the point of even struggling now. I think the bullpen's pretty taxed. But the offense has been inconsistent at best, bad at worst. You know, I think the Tigers are, again, in the bottom third of the league. And worse than that, it seems like their good days are okay and their bad days, you're just wondering when they're going to get a hit. You have a lot of young hitters in this lineup, some guys that have just not taken off, like Colt Keith, a rookie, Spencer Torkelson. Everyone was hoping he could replicate or build on a 31 homer season he had last year. It just hasn't come together. He seems to be late on fastballs constantly. We've seen some bright spots in Riley Green, but even he has been a little bit streaky. And it seems like once you get to 6, 7, 8, 9 hitters, this order can dry out real fast. You're looking at Javier Baez, who has not improved at all. In fact, he's gotten even worse from last year. So I think, you know, diagnosing the struggles of this team, it comes down to offense. And that has placed a huge burden on the pitching staff to almost be perfect every time out. And obviously that's just not realistic or sustainable.
Yeah, that sounds very, very familiar, by the way, covering this Toronto right. Blue Jays team right now. We're headed for a lot of 3-2 games this weekend, it seems like. You mentioned Javi Baez. I wanted to dig in on a couple of the like more young, exciting guys in Detroit. But you mentioned Javi Baez. I know you're a guy who appreciates the stats and things like that. Was he like when we got access to the bat speed and swing length stuff, was he the first guy you were like, all right, control F, Baez, let's see exactly what's going on here?
Absolutely. And I was actually surprised that Javi still ranks high up there in terms of bat speed. I had this theory that his bat just doesn't move the same way it did, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. I guess we don't have the data from then to know for sure, but we know he still has one of the quickest bats, some of the quickest hands in the entire league, which almost makes it even more puzzling why he's not able to replicate the success. And when it comes down to it, Javi Baez actually strikes out far less than he did even 3 years ago. The biggest difference in his game, there's no power anymore. He still has the same approach. There's a ton of chase, but he used to connect, and when he connected, he did real damage, and we just are not seeing that anymore. To me, when I saw the bat speed data, that only made it all the more puzzling.
Yeah, he's got that long swing, and so sometimes this comes with bat speed, but it's a different thing when you're like Giancarlo Stanton sized versus when you're Javier Baez sized to have like an 8-foot swing. It's a lot of I guess extra movement for lack of a better way to describe it with Baez. Some of those, so maybe Baez, you know, that's a case where at 31, 32, you know, maybe it's a decline that's not coming back. Some of these other guys are going to have brighter days ahead. Torkelson, you mentioned, he's really struggled to hit the ball for power. He's at 3 home runs for the season. What has gone on with that? Because he's a guy who I know he had a tough debut in 2022, but he was so young. And then last year, you really started to see kind of proof of concept as the season went along. But even something like his ability to take a lot of walks has seemed to dry up a little bit this year.
Yeah, I keep using kind of the words like puzzling and perplexing anytime I talk about this stuff. With Torkelson, I mean, it's a perfect example. Here's a guy who we know he's a talented player. He was a 1-1 draft pick, and we know that he's not destined to be a bust because he hit 31 homers last year. And yet there's some things about his game that just kind of don't make sense. I mean, look at his heat maps. He struggles almost pitches in the middle of the plate. He seems to constantly be either late or whiff or foul off middle fastballs. I think that did lead to some pressing, which maybe led to, you know, a worse plate approach. Maybe that explains the walk rate. He can be, I would argue, almost too passive at the plate sometimes. He seems to be down 0-1 all the time. I think pitchers know they can jump in and steal a strike. So when you're down 0-1, that's going to hurt your ability to draw walks. It's going to hurt your ability to hit for power in theory. But even when pitchers have missed, we have not seen him do a ton of damage. I think he's got 3 home runs, 2 were on hanging sliders. One was on, I believe, like a 92 mile an hour fastball. I think it comes down to timing for him. The Tigers have really worked trying to get more intent in his swing and his load. They want even his takes to show more aggressiveness, more intent to hammer the ball. And we've seen his performance tick up a little bit, but we're still kind of waiting for that breakthrough that he hit actually around this time last year.
Well, maybe it'll come. And you mentioned the stuff in the heart of the plate, and the run value data isn't everything, but, you know, per Baseball Savant's data, minus 22 runs of run value in the heart of the plate over his career so far. So relative to a league average player, you know, leaving something on the table by not jumping on those pitches in the heart of the plate a little bit more. Okay, so things haven't been that great for Torkelson. We've seen a couple guys play pretty well despite the team struggling overall. Wenzel Perez has had a nice little start to his season. Riley Green, you mentioned, has been up and down, but he does have 9 home runs. They use him in all 3 outfield spots. Would those guys kind of rank at the top of the list of positives on the position player side?
Yeah, I think absolutely. You know, Riley Green, again, can be a little bit of a victim of his own success and expectations. When he's good, he is so good. And I think that, you know, when he's slumping, or, you know, even just you'll see some bad swings, some bad at bats from Riley at times. And it's a little frustrating because, you know, he can be absolutely one of the best young hitters in baseball. He's really been going through it the past 14 games or so, but he does have 9 homers, leads the team in WAR. It's done a lot of really positive things. Still a young guy trying to even out the peaks and valleys a little bit. And Wenzel Perez has really been the biggest surprise on this team. A guy I didn't even foresee really spending much time in the big leagues, if any, this year. He got a chance early in the season, and he has run with it. He has proven, here's a young player. All these other young guys, they're struggling, and we hear, oh, you have to be patient, it's hard to adjust to the big leagues. Well, for whatever reason, Wenzel Perez has not needed time to adjust to the big leagues. He has come in. He was really hot early, kind of thought it would taper off, and it's evened out, but he's remained productive, plays the game hard, switch hitter. He's new to the outfield. He's not a great defensive outfielder, but he's been able to hold his own enough to play out there. He's playing a lot of center field. He's really been probably the best storyline in terms of position players on this team.
Yeah, this is maybe a little off topic. I know when Matt Vierling's in there, they'll trust him in center field, but the Riley Green and Wenzel Perez outfield defense dynamic, I know Mark Canna's in there sometimes, but they do seem to just kind of like rotate them around. Is that kind of the point, to see who ends up being the best in each spot? Because I know Riley's kind of settled in and left, but he has played a little center, a little right. Perez has bounced around a little bit. All these guys seem to have bounced around a little bit.
Yeah, I think the goal with Riley is to keep him in the corners for now, just a means of a little less work on his body, a little less stress after a lot of injuries the first 2 seasons of his big league career. It has become a little bit mix and match, because that's because the Tigers went into the year hoping Parker Meadows could be their everyday center fielder. He's a plus defender. He covered a ton of ground. They really banked a lot on that, I think, in terms of roster construction. And then Meadows struggled mightily at the plate. They had to send him down a little more than a month in. I think the plan A backup plan would have been Matt Vierling in center field. He ended up playing more third when Gio Urshela was on the injured list. And then Perez just kept earning at bats. So it's really become a lot of some mixing and matching between Perez and Vierling. And that's also dependent on what's going on at third base, you know, because we've seen Vierling play a lot there.
With respect to Meadows, I know it's only been 11 games back down in AAA. They're probably not going to hot shot him right back up, but he's hit pretty well. I'm scouting the stat line here a little bit. Could that be a short stint in AAA, or are they going to try to, you know, really make sure he's where he needs to be before he comes back up?
Yeah, that's kind of a great question. I think, you know, in an ideal world, it would be a short stint. I just, you know, spoke to why he's been so important to their roster construction, a guy they had banked a lot on. At the same time, even when they sent him down, I think the Tigers cautioned, hey, don't get too invested in the AAA stat line, because we've seen it before with Parker Meadows. We've seen it with Colt Keith last year, Spencer Torkelson, all these guys who seem to dominate AAA, and then they get up to the big leagues and quickly you find out it's a different game. So I think they're looking for more how he handles velocity. Is he still getting fooled on breaking pitches down and in? How's he hitting the slider? Probably things even more granular than that even you and I would barely understand. I think they're really looking at the process more than the stat line. And you know, when someone's away in AAA, it's a little harder to tell what's actually going on under the hood.
Yeah, and you know, we've gone through this on the Blue Jays side as well. You know, Alek Manoah down there. Hey, what do you make of a 12 strikeout game? What do you make of getting shelled at single A? And then he comes up, and you know, it looks how it looks. So yeah, can't just scout the stat line. Always a helpful reminder for us and for fans. Want to spin to the pitching side? So we have a couple of the probables for this weekend for the Tigers, and Jack Flaherty, who's a pretty known commodity, having a nice bounce back season after a down last year. Matt Manning's going to start Friday, and then question marks Saturday and Sunday. We've heard maybe Kenta Maeda could be back off the IL. Reese Olson took that comebacker. Casey Mize is in the mix there. Do you have a sense of what the Tigers are waiting on or what they're working through with those Saturday, Sunday starters?
Yeah, I think it's probably mostly dependent on Maeda, and that could be also somewhat dependent on Olson. I think Olson's going to be good to go. Not sure what they're going to do with Maeda. They've talked about him just not being fully built up after missing a lot of time with an illness. But also given how much he struggled before that illness, I think there could be some merit to having him do another rehab start. It's just a little bit of a matter of how the Tigers want to be able to mix and match the rotation there. So they tend to keep these things pretty close to the vest. I don't want to guess too much. I just will say I think this weekend's probables hinge all on Kenta Maeda.
If Kenta Maeda were to be back, Casey Mize has kind of, I don't know, I know Eno Saris, your counterpart at The Athletic, kind of pointed this out recently. The fastball's just like kind of fallen off. And I know the overall numbers in 2022 when we last saw him weren't that great, but this is a guy who pitched 150 really good innings back in 2021. It's not that long ago. He's not an old player. Like we'd think he's still like on the way up. What have you seen from Mize underneath this 4.57 ERA in the early going here?
Yeah, it's so interesting because it was a big storyline in spring training, just how hard all these guys were throwing out of the gate. Mize, maybe number one on that list, was throwing harder than ever, getting way more vertical ride on his fastball than ever before. And that was a positive development. Everyone was applauding it, but there was kind of this sense in the background, okay, this is great in March. Can you do it in July, August, September? Well, we're here toward the end of May, and we're already seeing Casey Mize tail off. That does lead you to wonder what's going on. Is this a mechanical thing? Is this a fatigue thing? How's the rest of his body doing? Overall, Casey Mize is a guy coming back from Tommy John surgery. His last outing against the Royals was really rough, but I think you have to be pretty pleased. His stuff, even though it's regressed a little bit, has been good. The splitter has been the best we've seen it in a long time. You're starting to be reminded that Casey Mize, at the very least, can be a quality major league pitcher. But it is a little bit concerning how quickly the stuff has regressed here. So I'll be interested to see if he has any mechanical tweaks or anything else to kind of address that in his next outing coming up.
With respect to Flaherty, who's going to start tonight, kind of a vet addition that I think spoke to what you were saying earlier about Tigers fans expecting this team to be, you know, in the mix in the AL Central. They did add some vet guys to kind of support the young cast that was coming up and growing together. He has corrected a lot of what didn't work for him last year. What have you seen for Flaherty? What should we look out for compared to, you know, when we saw him late last year with the Orioles?
Yeah, I mean, I do think pitching development, both in the lower level and at the major league level, is the thing probably the Tigers are doing best in their organization right now, and Flaherty is a great testament to that. He was a guy, although he was a veteran, probably the least popular Tigers offseason addition. A guy even I wasn't sure like how he was really going to fit in. Here's a guy whose performance has just tapered off. He'd been through some injuries. How much was really more left in the tank was kind of my thought. Well, Jack Flaherty and the Tigers quickly proved any doubters wrong because he's been dynamite. He's striking out double digits per nine innings. His slider has really looked like 2019 Jack Flaherty. He's got a little extra giddy up on the fastball. His command has been really good, too. He is limiting walks to an extreme degree and missing a ton of bats. He's had a couple outings that have not gone perfectly for him. Maybe a pitch or two he would like back here or there that have blemished the ERA. But Jack Flaherty has been really good. It's actually been kind of astounding just to see how a few mechanical adjustments, some biomechanical stuff has led to him looking like Jack Flaherty circa 2019.
Okay, one last pitching question for you. Why do so many of the Tigers pitchers wear single digit jersey numbers?
It's a great question, one I appreciate. And I really have no idea other than just straight coincidence. Jack Flaherty, he had never worn nine before, but It's the number he wore growing up. It was available, so he took it. Shelby Miller, who's on the IL, basically the numbers he wanted were kind of taken when he came over to the Tigers. 7 happens to be his wife's high school volleyball number, and his wife is from Metro Detroit. And then Bo Brisky, 4, that's kind of the number he has worn most of his life. But the Tigers are the first team in the history of the American League, which is wild, to have 3 pitchers wear single-digit jerseys in the same season. Speaks to how much of a stigma there for a long time has been against pitchers wearing single digits. Also speaks to the fact that it's kind of silly. I don't think anyone really cares about it anymore.
Yeah, it's a fun note, and I saw you write the story about it. I was like, let's bring it up. The first time it's happened in like 100 years is crazy. I don't think about jersey numbers all that much. I'm a football fan, but I couldn't tell you like, oh yeah, these numbers are for this position or whatever. It just doesn't stick with me for that much. So I found that really really fascinating. Last one before I let you go, cover this series. Enjoy your weekend, Cody. It's Thursday, not Friday. I got to keep reminding myself of that. Bobby Witt gets caught stealing on a pitch out the other day, and the Tigers broadcast is suggesting that maybe Tarik Skubal and Jake Rogers baited him into that by using the pickoff moves and then pitching out, thinking Bobby Witt was likelier to steal when Skubal didn't have any more disengagements left. What did you make of that? Did you get a chance to ask about that, or what was your read on that? It's a pretty clever thing if that's what they were doing.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting listening to AJ Hinch and Tarik Skubal after the game. They denied that, said it was kind of more coincidence. The pitch just happened to be high, and it you know, they knew he was going to go, so that they did it with that in mind. But they kind of denied that it was any sort of baiting or like a called pitch out or anything to that effect. I'll just say I'm not sure if I believe that, because it seems like quite the clever play that I think we could be seeing more often.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if they do it again. The Jays probably aren't the team to look for it against. They don't run a ton. They don't have a guy who runs like Bobby Witt. But interesting to see how that unfolds anyway. Cody, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning, man. Keep up the great work.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me anytime.
Cody Stavenhagen of The Athletic, of the Turning the Corner podcast. Tigers team, pretty fascinating one. I mentioned before we talked to Cody there that it's a bit of an unconventional schedule for this series, so keep an eye out for that. 6:40 start time today and tomorrow. So you're looking at 6:00 for Blue Jay Central. 6:30, we'll pick you up for the broadcast. It's Dan, Joe, and Hazel for this series. Jamie and Caleb will have you for Blue Jay Central at 6:00. Ben Shulman and Chris LaRue on the radio call with Show Ali hosting, and Ben Nicholson-Smith down there covering the series for us for .ca. So 6:40 on Thursday and Friday, 1:10 on Saturday, and then 11:35 a.m. on Sunday, part of a new MLB national package with Roku. No effect to us here in Canada. You'll still have the Sportsnet broadcast on television as usual. We'll talk more about this series tomorrow, of course, but a couple other things to look out for. Bowden Francis made that rehab appearance yesterday. That's his third one. Again, scouting the stat line here because I didn't get to watch that one, but looked fine over his 3 appearances. He's at 6 2/3 innings, 5 hits and a walk, 6 strikeouts, 3 runs, but only 2 of them earned. So he could be ready to rejoin the team. Chad Green expected to pitch today with the Bisons in an afternoon game. Yariel Rodriguez, TBD for his next steps because his Tuesday one got cut a little short. It's Kevin Gausman against Jack Flaherty tonight. Jack Flaherty, we talked about it with Cody. He's back. We're talking 97th percentile whiff rate. So how often are you getting guys to swing and miss at pitches? 95th percentile strikeout rate. He's also a 94th percentile walk rate. So when you're looking at strikeouts and walks, he's not putting any extra guys on base, missing a lot of bats. The batted ball stuff when you do make contact is reasonable. If we looked at if expected ERA based on how often you get swing and miss at the quality of contact, that's down at 291. So some good stuff here, even though the fastball is still, you know, still 94 mile an hour fastball that he throws about 40% of the time. But you're looking at a slider he throws 30% of the time that has nasty swing and miss rates, a good knuckle curve that he'll mix in there to hitters on both sides. Flaherty's a guy who he doesn't really change his pitch mix a ton. Righty lefty, he'll give it to you both sides with that slider and that knuckle curve. Change up and a sinker you'll see once in a while, but not significantly. The Jays have seen him enough, 68 plate appearances against him, a 132 batting average and a 226 slugging. Justin Turner, the lone player to homer off of Jack Flaherty. On the other side, Kevin Gausman, obviously not at his best just yet. The velocity down a little bit on the fastball and the splitter. The whiff rate down pretty significantly. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. The Tigers have seen a decent amount of him. Middling results, nothing too special. Riley Green has gone 3-for-5 with a walk off of him, though. Thank you to Keegan Matheson, Cody Stabenhagen, and Travis Sawchuk for coming on today. Thanks to you guys for the calls and texts. We'll try to do that a little more regularly here. Thank you to Amit Mann for handling the text line and the call line so we could do that segment. Thank you to Lance Kennedy and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass as well. We will be back to talk to you at 10 a.m. tomorrow. Have a good day.